On this episode of the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast, we dive into telekinesis experiments, holograms and paranormal investigations, Edgegrave Dave reviews Teen Wolf, and much, much more. So pour yourself a drink. Well, I mean, not if you're driving, because that's not cool. Anyway, let's go.
Do aliens exist, and are they among us? Are weird creatures lurking in the darkness? Do evil entities hide in the shadows of your bedroom while you sleep? Join us as we explore all this and more on the Warped Reality Podcast.
What's happening, everybody? I have an awesome show for you guys tonight. I know I say that all the time, but, you know, we're here to do some awesome content. So why wouldn't it be an awesome show, right? So last week's episode, I talked with Ken Bartholomew, who's a holographic healer and a practitioner of telekinesis. If you haven't checked out our YouTube, I encourage you to do so. The links are always in the show notes every week. Please go there and subscribe. You'll see his whole interview with a demonstration of his telekinetic abilities. Awesome, awesome stuff. You could also check it out at the Get Haunted USA Facebook page as well. Very, very cool. He gives a demonstration, and mind you, it wasn't too long because I was on Zoom, and Zoom kind of sucks, man, because every time I was talking, it would go to each person that's talking. But when the both of us weren't talking and he was doing his thing, for some reason, Zoom was focused on me and I couldn't get it focused on him. So ridiculous, right? I was kind of upset about that, but you see enough of it to want to see more. And if you want to see more of what he can do, check out all of his show notes in last week's episode. So definitely do that. So we touched a little bit on telekinesis in the beginning of that episode, but I'm going to go into a little bit more detail right now. So as you know, telekinesis, the ability to move objects with the mind, it's fascinated scientists and paranormal researchers for decades. While there's no definitive proof that telekinesis is real, check last week's episode, there have been several famous experiments and cases that have intrigued believers and skeptics alike. The Nina Kalinga experiments is about a Russian woman named Nina Kalinga was said to have demonstrated telekinetic abilities in the 1960s. Soviet scientists reportedly studied her, claiming she could move objects without touching them. Then you have the peer studies, or the pair studies, I guess you would say. The pair studies, which stands for Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research. It was conducted at Princeton University, guys. Princeton University. These experiments explored whether human consciousness could influence physical systems, including random number generators. Then you have the Uri Geller phenomenon. Uri Geller, a famous psychic, claimed to have telekinetic abilities, including bending spoons with his mind. His demonstrations were met with both fascination and skepticism. Then you have the Stanford Research Institute experiments. In the 1970s, researchers at Stanford studied individuals who claimed to have psychic abilities, including telekinesis, as part of a government-funded investigations into paranormal phenomenon. Then, of course, and we've talked about this one before, but super, super interesting, the Philip experiment. It was a Canadian study in the 1970s, and it attempted to create a fictional ghost through collective belief. While not strictly telekinesis, participants reported unexplained movements of objects during seances of a made-up ghost, guys. So that's pretty crazy. Let's talk a little bit about the Stanford Research Institute study of it. So in the 1970s, the Stanford Research Institute conducted experiments on psychic phenomena, including telekinesis, under government-funded programs, as I said. The research primarily focused on remote viewing, the ability to perceive distant locations without physical presence. Scientists like Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff led the studies, working with individuals who claimed to have psychic abilities. While telekinesis was not the main focus, the experiments explored whether human consciousness could influence physical objects or events. The results were controversial, with skeptics arguing that the findings lacked scientific rigor. Then you'll have the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab. Let's talk a little bit about that one. So the peer lab, or the pair lab, excuse me, was founded by Robert Jahn at Princeton University, studied the effects of human consciousness on physical systems from 1979 to 2007. One of its key experiments involved random number generators, machines designed to produce unpredictable sequences. Researchers tested whether individuals could mentally influence the RNGs, and some results suggested small but statistically significant effects. However, mainstream scientists criticized the methodology, arguing that the findings could be attributed to chance. The lab eventually closed, but its research remains a topic of debate in the field of consciousness studies. You can explore more details if you'd like. Again, show notes, check it out. So both studies contributed to the ongoing discussion about the potential influence of the mind on physical reality. And I mean, just the fact that these two places are so prestigious and they were looking into this kind of means something, doesn't it? So now let's imagine a world where holograms not only defy physical space, but allow us to interact with the beyond in ways previously thought impossible. This breakthrough in tactile 3D holograms might just be the next leap forward for paranormal investigations and experiences. By using flexible, elastic materials in their design, these holograms can be touched, grabbed, and poked without disrupting the projection. This could potentially allow investigators to simulate touch with entities or objects from another realm, creating a whole new dimension of immersive ghost hunting. For paranormal enthusiasts, such as technology could enhance seances, visualizing spectral presences in lifelike forms while interacting with them. Haunted museums exhibits could transform into deeply engaging experiences where visitors can feel and move ghostly artifacts. Even cryptid hunters could benefit. Imagine analyzing 3D holographic evidence or recreating sightings in a way that's touchable. This innovation might also spark theories about the interaction between energy-based phenomena and holographic projections. Could this be a bridge to better understand and communicate with the supernatural? I guess we'll just have to wait and see what technology brings us, you know? So now let's talk about some ghost tools, right? Now, we've all heard of EVP recorders and dowsing rods and, you know, different things like that, you know, ultraviolet cameras and all this sort of stuff, right? But let's talk about a few that you might not know about, right? But they're still kind of primitive in a way for some point of it. So let's talk about pendulums. Pendulums have long been a cherished tool in the realm of paranormal investigations, serving as an intriguing medium for uncovering hidden energies and connecting with spirits. This simple yet powerful device, often crafted from crystal or metal, swings on a chain or thread to provide answers and insights beyond our physical reality. For ghost hunters, pendulum sessions start with calibration, establishing distinct movements for yes, no, or neutral. By the way, I did this as a human pendulum thing when I went for the Mid-Orange Correctional Facility ghost investigation with the Get Haunted crew. So once calibrated, investigators pose focused questions to spirits, interpreting the pendulum's movements as direct responses. Beyond communication, pendulums can be used to detect energy hotspots, helping pinpoint areas where supernatural activity might be stirring. This tool's versatility shines when paired with other investigative devices like EVP sessions or ghost boxes, creating a more holistic approach to uncovering the paranormal. While skeptics argue the pendulum's movement stems from micro movements in the hand, the ideomotor effect, many investigators firmly believe in its ability to channel spiritual energy. So now let's talk about the dead bell. No, it's not the church bell that you hear in the beginning of For Whom the Bell Tolls or the AC/DC song Hell's Bells or anything like that. This is a little bell. It kind of looks like, I guess you could probably get them different sizes. But the bell that I saw at the investigation was kind of a large bell, but it actually is charged and all this stuff. Like it's a, not electric, but I guess you charge it up. So a dead bell, it's a chilling mix of tradition and technology. The dead bell serves as a trigger object in investigations. Its eerie chime echoes death rituals, making it a compelling tool to draw spirit interaction. Modern versions now incorporate EMF sensors as well to detect energy fluctuations often linked to paranormal activity. When energy is detected, the bell rings, providing a tangible signal of potential supernatural presence. Combining symbolic resonance with technological precision, the dead bell is a must-have for investigators seeking to connect with entities through both sound and energy. And then we have cat balls. Yes, you heard me correctly. Cat balls, you know, the little balls that the cats kick around and stuff like that, that light up and everything. So cat balls, obviously, they're originally designed for cat toys. But since the early 2020s, investigators recognized their potential as affordable and effective tools for detecting spirit activity due to their sensitivity to movement and ability to light up in response. For example, they were notably used during a seance at Airtight Bridge in October 2022, where their activation was interpreted as possible spirit interaction. Their simplicity and visual cues make them ideal for ghost hunts, especially when paired with other EVP tools and thermal cameras as well. So there's a little history for you about the newer tools. I guess maybe not so new, but new enough that a lot of places aren't using it, or they're using it now and they weren't a few years back. So enough of me. You've been hearing me talk for about 12 minutes now, so I'm sure you're sick and tired of hearing my voice. So now let's talk to Edgegrave Dave while he reviews one of my favorites and one of my favorite actors, Teen Wolf. Let's go.
Horrible reviews with Edgegrave Dave.
Edgegrave Dave is here, and I'm going to discuss and review a movie that I was warned, I was told, I was protested against my own family of little gravediggers not to do. Maybe I shouldn't do it. What's going to happen? What if it's not scary enough? What if it's not creepy enough? Well, I got news for you. Did you know that I am a nationally fully certified and endorsed horror finder? That's right. I can find horror in just about anything. As a matter of fact, I am a certified, endorsed National Horror Finder, INC. But don't go looking that up, grave diggers, because you might not find it. And besides, Edgegrave Dave always has time to celebrate a birthday. And did you know that back in 1985, the 40th anniversary, 40 years ago, both Back to the Future and Teen Wolf came out within a month of each other? And normally, I wouldn't talk about a family comedy film, but you know what? Teen Wolf was a very significant film in Michael J. Fox's career back in the day. And this was when it was really taken off. I mean, you had family ties with Back to the Future in July of 1985, and then come August, we had Teen Wolf. I wouldn't be surprised if there were some theaters that had oversaturated Michael. Oversaturated Michael. Showing both films at the same time. But both films were more than a moderate success. And although both films were a success, they are definitely not created equal. Sometimes you just got to give back to the children of the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast, because I believe the children are our future. And you know what else? That song by Whitney Houston came out in 1985 too, along with a slew of other werewolf movies. We had Back to the... Am I really going to say Back to the Future again? I mean, I guess because I just love that damn movie so much. But in 1985, we had Stephen King's Silver Bullet, The Howling 2, Transylvania 6-5000, I hope I'm saying that one right, and then something strange seemed to happen. Every 10 years, we had a decade of other werewolf movies. We had The Howling, New Moon Rising in 1995, Metal Beast and Huntress. Then another 10 years, we had Wes Craven's Cursed in 2005, Wild Country, and The Beast of Bray Road. 10 years after that, in 2015, we had Howl, Crying Wolf, and Silver Hide. What is going on here? It seemed to culminate with Wolfman, which we had recently discussed here. And right behind its tail, we had Werewolves that came out just around the holidays in 2024. Still in theaters, though, in 2025. There is definitely some kind of strange correlation. So, class, I think it's time to put our thinking caps on, because this Edgegrave math is really howling for some horror. And the howling for horror that I had growing up in the 80s started with a precursor, with movies that go a little something like this. You see, Teen Wolf was the very first live-action werewolf that I ever saw in a movie as a little boy growing up. As a matter of fact, and this one goes right to you, Ghost Joe, Harry and the Hendersons, that was my first encounter with Bigfoot right there. And for that matter, Skeletor in the live-action Masters of the Universe, and the cartoon for that matter, live-action skeleton that I ever got into a encounter with. I should almost edit this out, but the fact that I started laughing is just really funny. Man, talk about precursors for horror. Things like Madballs and the Garbage Pail Kids and all the toys that we had, all these things would lead to the young adult horror individuals that we became and are now. So, Edgegrave warning, spoiler alert, let's get right into this. As kids and as teenagers, we've always had the conversation about the birds and the bees and how your body's going to go through changes. Well, in the case of Scott Howard, a terrible basketball player that, to be honest, I don't even know why he was on the team to begin with. I don't even think that he was enjoying it very much. He really never had the talk about the birds and the bees. Maybe he should have had the talk about the werewolf and the trees, because he's starting to go through changes. He's starting to notice that he's got a little bit of hair growing on his chest and in other places. He's starting to notice that he's starting to grow fangs. And then one day he notices that, and this is maybe one of the few, if you can even call it horror, one day he has a full total wolf out session in his bathroom where he's getting really scared. His face contorts, his eyes glow red, and then in a very comedic way, again, nothing really scary about this, he full on becomes a werewolf. As it turns out, being a werewolf runs in the family. This has always been one of the points I just never understood, why his father couldn't really prepare him. In a very strange comparison, in The Fly 2, Martin never knew that he was going to become a fly like his father. Oddly enough, in The Fly 2, Martin was played by Eric Stoltz, who was also cast as the original Marty McFly in Back to the Future before that role went to Michael J. Fox. And as a matter of fact, Michael J. Fox was in family ties with Justine Bateman, who's the older sister of Jason Bateman, who was Teen Wolf in Teen Wolf 2, the sequel in 1987. Oh man, I am Edgegrave Daving this one up with the facts. I digress. One of his best friends is a childhood friend named Boof. She grew up with him and she has a major crush on him. And he also has a friend named Styles. This guy reminds me of like every 80s really kind of funny side character that I can think of. He reminds me of like Animal House or maybe like Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He's just kind of like a dude. And the freaking t-shirts that this guy wears. Shirts like, what are you staring at, dick nose? Life sucks and then you die. Obnoxious the movie. Again, this was a PG movie in the 80s. And nothing about this really surprises me. If you look at the amount of language that was done, and I'm going to mention again because I have to, Back to the Future. And if you look at even things like Ghostbusters, times are very, very different then. And three movies that changed, that were the catalyst going to PG-13 from PG, were in fact Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom in 84, Gremlins in 84, and here we go again, Back to the Future. A slew of other complaints were done from other films as well. And before long, PG-13 was there. But things weren't really there yet. you know, maybe as an Edgegrave warning. This is definitely a family film that you could watch, but just beware. You know, there's alcohol use in it. You know, there is some sex stuff in the movie, but all in all, the movie is really about the changes that Scott is going through, and he becomes, here's a twister, a shocking turn for those who didn't know, extremely popular as the werewolf. His basketball skills improve. His status improves with popularity. He's walking around in shades. There's a really funny scene where he can even get a keg of beer, and the guy that's in the liquor store denying everybody of an ID. Sometimes I say that's worth the price of admission. Those scenes are just really funny. But this guy can do almost anything as the wolf. But his childhood friend, the girl that has a crush on him, Boof, really likes Scott for who he is inside. And every basketball game that they play, it started out with almost nobody there. They were losing horribly. All of a sudden, those bleachers are packed. They're doing great. They want the wolf. They want the wolf. But he still doesn't know how to really manage himself as the popularity as being the wolf. And in the beginning of the movie, how to control it. It's not until later that we realize just being yourself is what's the most important. So there is a life lesson in here. There's a lot of cheese in the movie with this. Some of the special effects, when he's the wolf, it really reminds me of like a werewolf costume that you'd find, or maybe something like a wolfman type costume. I could almost notice where some of the fur was coming off of the arm on when he's running down the basketball court with this. It's just really funny. But these are things that they happen so fast that you don't even realize it. The acting from really just about everybody, though everybody did their best, felt a little bit generic to me. You know, there wasn't really a big focus on a lot of characters. Styles and all of his friends, all those jokers are really pretty funny, as they do want to try to use his wolf power to their advantage. And there's a party scene and you got to be the wolf. And he starts to realize, you know what? I told you guys that I am a fully certified horror finder. The real horror is life. And sometimes growing up, it's just a little bit hard to kind of be yourself and kind of find yourself. The movie uses being a wolf as sort of a drug in a way, or as like a superpower, something to really hide behind who you are. But at the very end of the movie, he goes through a whole circle and turnaround of events. His powers are now manageable. He decides he wants to play the basketball game as Scott Howard. They've been losing the whole time. He's been mega popular. And well, you know what? At the very end, there's a nice slow motion shot. That basket goes in and the team wins the game while they zoom in on some dude's freaking fly being open in the bleachers. Don't believe me. Just either, if you don't watch this movie, Google it. It's absolutely hysterical. Special shout out to my boy Vinny for reminding me and pointing that out again when I watch this. But the type of movie that this really is, it's really very strange. And the strangeness really does work with the symmetry of this movie. But again, this is a family film, so I'm not like expecting any blood or guts or anything crazy like that. It's just that the movie, all in all, kind of disguises itself as a werewolf movie when it's really about a puberty and a sports movie, where instead of going through puberty as humans, you're using the wolf to teach people about who they're going to become as a young adult. And for that, I respect what it did, but I'm going to have to give this movie about a 2.5 out of 5 graves. Not that it's a bad movie. There's just so much like genericness in the film that I think that they could have built possibly a little bit more on the werewolf folklore department or the special effects department, or just giving us a little bit more. But you definitely would not have the success of this movie without Michael J. Fox. His star shone very, very bright on this one. And I also just have to mention, I did find out this film happened to be filmed on the very same street as Back to the Future. That's right. George McFly and Lorraine's house in that movie in 1955 was on the same street as Scott Howard's house. Isn't that nice? You have all these connections. So if you do happen to check this one out, enjoy it. I also did learn that there was a Teen Wolf dramedy type series that came out that did build upon some of the folklore. I am going to have to check this out. And it's still pretty recent, as this is 2025. After the series ended, there was a 2023 movie about that. So go ahead and enjoy. Back to you, Ghost Joe.
Ow!
So much for that awesome review, as usual, Edgegrave. Yeah, listen, you could review any Michael J. Fox movie, and it's totally cool with me. I don't care if it's horror or not. It's my podcast. I could do what I want. All right. Michael J. Fox is Michael J. Fox. He's awesome. He's our childhood. You could do any movie you want from Michael J. Fox. Horror, not horror, whatever. You know what I mean? So I actually, that's crazy though about the 10-year thing with the werewolves. That's very, very strange, actually. I never actually put that together. And that's a good find, buddy. That's a good find right there. So thank you again, Edgegrave. And how dare your family say that anything with Michael J. Fox is not good enough for this podcast. So, yeah. So now let's talk about something that actually my 11-year-old daughter brought this up to me. And for some reason, I didn't know, but now I do. So, because I did some research. So, did you guys know that the movie Scream, of course, made by Wes Craven, 1996, that they've coming up with, what, Scream 7 coming out soon? Yeah, it's at this point, like, all right, come on now. But anyway, the first one, monumental, loved it. Loved that movie. The ending, super cool twist. Great movie. Anyway, did you guys know that it was inspired by a true story? This is insane, right? So let me start this off for you right now. So the 1996 horror hit Scream stunned audiences with its masked killer Ghostface and clever twists. But behind the fiction lies chilling reality. Danny Rowling, the Gainesville Ripper, whose gruesome crimes in 1990 haunted a college town and inspired screenwriter Kevin Williamson. Rolling murder spree left 5 Florida students dead in just 4 days, mirroring themes of fear, suspense, and horror obsession that define the movie, right? So let's get into some of these parallels right now. So you got the terrified college towns, right? So Gainesville in 1990 was gripped by terror as students feared as an unknown killer was on the loose. Similarly, Scream's fictional Woodsboro faces chaos as Ghostface wreaks havoc, right? Then you have the mystery of the killer's identity. Gainesville police struggled to uncover Rowling's identity before his arrest, an eerie parallel to Scream, where Ghostface's identity is a shocking reveal at the end, right? Then you have posing victims. Rowling posed some of his victims in disturbing ways, heightening the horror and amplifying the fear within the community. In Scream, Ghostface's methodical, I can't talk tonight, and theatrical killings evoke similar spine-chilling dread. Then you have a killer's love for horror. Rowling's fascination with movies like The Exorcist 3, great movie, by the way. I actually just saw The Exorcist 3 not too long ago. That movie is great, man. Much better than Exorcist 2, which he reportedly watched before committing his crimes, connects him to Scream's killers who are horror fanatics, right? Crafting their murders with slasher tropes. Then you have the psychological complexity. Rowling's abusive childhood and violent psyche echo the twisted motivations of Scream's killers, blending dark psychological themes with personal vendettas. Inspired by a documentary on Rowling's spree, Williamson intertwined real-life horror with slasher elements to create Scream. Though the film takes creative liberties, it echoes of Rowling's spree, right? From posed victims to a fear-stricken community, remind us that some nightmares originate in reality. Williamson's brilliance transform those fears into a horror masterpiece that chills us to this day.
Hey, Reddit. I don't even know how to start this. I'm still shaking. This happened last night, and I need to know if anyone has experienced anything like it. I live alone in a small apartment, nothing fancy, just enough to get by. Last night, I woke up around 3 a.m. to the sound of scratching. Not outside, inside. It was coming from my closet. I told myself it was just the wind or maybe a rat, but deep down, I knew better. I grabbed my phone, turned on the flashlight, and forced myself to check. The closet door creaked open, but there was nothing inside except my hanging clothes. I sighed in relief. But then, I saw it. In the reflection of my dresser mirror, something was standing behind me. Tall, gaunt, charcoal black skin. Its eyes, God, its eyes weren't eyes at all. Just deep, hollow pits. I swear to you, it was smiling. I turned around fast, but there was nothing there. I bolted out of my apartment and spent the night in my car, too scared to go back inside. But when I checked the mirror in my rear view, it was there again, watching me. This morning, I forced myself to go back inside. The air in my apartment feels heavier, like something is pressing against my chest. Doors creak open on their own. My TV turns on at random, but there's never a picture, just static. Worst of all, it's still watching me. I see it standing in doorways, reflected in windows, lurking in the corners of my vision. And every time I close my eyes, I feel it getting closer. Reddit, I need help. What do I do?
Well, that Reddit was pretty freaking scary. So anyway, that's going to do it for me, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please check out all of our show links in the show notes, as usual, as well as any guests and anything that I always put up there will always be in the show notes, as well as the Get Haunted Network links as well will always be in the show notes as well. So please check them out. Please check out our YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, and all that good stuff. Next week's episode will be my part one interview of Mark D'Antonio, who's an astronomer. And is with MUFON as well. Very, very cool. He talks about a lot about UFOs and how he believes that UFOs maneuver in the sky. Super interesting stuff. You're definitely not going to want to miss that. And I have a lot more great things coming up for you guys. So please stay tuned. And if you have a paranormal experience you'd like to share, please give me a call at 845-600-0744. Or you could email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You could always do so anonymously. And yeah. So have a great night, everybody. Later.
Thank you for listening to the Warp Reality Paranormal Podcast. And thank you to all of my guests and contributors that helped make this show possible. If you have a paranormal experience you'd like to share, questions, comments, or you'd like to be a guest in the show, please leave me a voicemail at 845-600-0744. Or you can email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You can do so anonymously if you'd like. Also, please check out our show notes for all social media links of this show and some of our friends. The Warp Reality Paranormal Podcast, uncovering the unseen.